Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon. This is episode 21-09, the ninth episode of 2021. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Voice of Freedom Behind Enemy Lines in the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you just stumbled across this, a friend shared it with you, there's a bunch of ways you can listen. You can find the podcast on various podcast players. I use Podbean, and it seems to work pretty well most of the time. Got a few glitches when you're traveling in bad cell phone areas, but other than that, it works really well. And if you'd do me a favor and follow this podcast on that platform, that would help me with the algorithm. And what that does is when you follow it and more people follow it, Podbean's algorithm looks at that and goes, people like this. Maybe I should tell this guy over here about it who likes the same things this guy likes and that. So that helps get the word out about the show, which ultimately helps with things like getting new sponsors and other stuff like that. So I'm going to talk about a couple different things today. Nothing new, hugely new to report in Virginia. There's been an easing of COVID restrictions in Virginia because our moron oaf of a governor, and gosh, he is dumb. Have you ever listened to him speak? How did he ever become governor? Usually somebody who's a politician has to have eloquence. There's no eloquence with him. I want to tell you all about COVID today. This is what we're going to do, everybody. My goodness. So this comes from a website called Raconteur Report. And he's talking about, this is really a response to a post by NC Renegade, guy out of North Carolina. Good patriot and good blog if you're interested in that. I will post a link to both of them. But it really spoke to me. It's kind of where my mind has been lately. And I think more people need to wake up to this. And he says, so let's talk turkey. There are three undeniable truths operating right now in America. Elections are pointless, worthless, and futile. If you didn't get that memo, despite what happened in November, and again in Georgia in January, sorry to break it to you, but it's nevertheless gospel truth. Anyone yakking about, we'll get them next time, vote harder, or any variation on more elections is an unredeemable, delusional moron suffering from a psychopathic break from reality. They should be placed in a room in a quiet glen featuring soft music, soft lighting, soft food, and soft walls. They're nuts. Don't waste any further breath on them until they wake up, if ever. He has an acronym here that he made up called TINVOWOOT. There is no voting our way out of this. Learn it, live it, love it, he says. Should you still pull a lever ever again? Yes. Enjoy whatever simulacrum of freedom you can and maximize the time and minimize the gradient of the decline, if such be within your power. Primary out rhinos, use it as a weed out for whom ever to listen to and whom to discount forever, and a platform to meme, rabble rouse, and generally send raspberries at TPTB, I'm not really sure what that is, while you can. But minimize the time, energy, and funds you spend, aka waste, on electoral activities going forward. Knowing the entire process is as fake as TV news and pro wrestling. I mean, he's spot on with that. He is spot on with that. I keep hearing this. Well, we're gonna work harder. Gotta get good people elected. How with all this vote fraud? How? And there is vote fraud. It's a real thing. It isn't fake news. The cases have not been settled. The courts never heard a single one of these cases. He continues, we're at war within this country with those who hate fundamental America. Not a debate, not an argument, not a fight, a war, W-A-R. They want you dead. They want you rounded up and obliterated. And they want to kill your unborn babies, kidnap your living children, and poison their minds against you. In the interim, They want you unemployed, broke, dispossessed of your goods, lands, and chattels, and treated like subhuman scum, which is what they think you are, to their marrow. And they'll stop at nothing to do exactly that. When your enemy tells you his true feelings, believe it. Mein Kampf was a blueprint for the Holocaust. Das Kapital was a blueprint and excuse for the Holodomor, the Great Leap Forward, and the killing fields. Scapegoats and counter-revolutionaries will not be tolerated. You are both. If you're reading this, that means you to a metaphysical certainty. But there is a difference between being at war and warfare. Your fight at this point is theoretical, philosophical, and moral. Point number three, you aren't ready to fight any other kind of actual war yet. As I noted to Wes, that's the author at NC Renegade, above, I share his frustration that this is so. Some of us have been trying to educate folks about this for years. As you might have noticed, to date, it hasn't helped much, other than as a pressure release valve for those of us watching the train wreck, transfixed, aghast, and infuriated. Which brings us to the teachable moment and the action implementation phase. I love that. The train wreck, transfixed, aghast, and infuriated. He's a good writer. Action implementation phase, get yourself ready for war. A, it's going to be a shooting war, so you'd better have something to shoot with and something to load into it, and you'd better get good with it. The good news is, even for GED-holding high school dropouts, that only takes a few hours a day, for a couple 3 weeks, even for Army Rangers and Marines, and a grand total of 260 rounds. Folks, that's nothing, in the grand scheme. Competence is not mastery, but start with bare competence. If you're looking for recommendations, there are plenty of good ones, but the AR platform is where to start. And you'll do just fine picking up a Smith & Wesson M&P 15, which is just a Civi M forgery. I actually don't like Smith & Wesson. Sorry if you have one. This is my commentary. I would go with the Palmetto State. Been really happy with that. Longevity has been really good. Plus 1,000 rounds, no issues. Few upgrades I would do to it, which I have. But I've got three of them. So they're great. Three different sizes, and they all work fantastic. He says, pistol ? Learn how to run a Glock. You can upgrade from all of this, and I hope you do, but that's the floor. I don't know if that's a Glock insult or what that is, but he's, you know, I was a Glock guy for many years. I think they're fantastic. They're reliable. I didn't like the trigger, which is really one of the huge reasons I switched away. There was nothing I could do. All the upgrades I'd done just didn't make a difference, and so I was transitioning from 40 caliber to 9mm just because of economics and age of myself, with my wrist just not being as strong as they used to be. The 40 was a little too much, so I said, well, I'm getting a 9mm, and I found I'm shooting a Canic, which has got an amazing trigger. It's been a really nice gun. So regardless, get a rifle and a pistol and get ammo to put in it. B, once you scratch the itch for your inner gear whore with the rifle and pistol, get your fat butt in shape. PT 3 to 5 times a week. Upper body, lower body aerobic, endurance exercise, strength building. And the shorthand for that is push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and running 2 to 3 miles. Running. Not walking, pedaling, driving, slow jogging, or anything else. Start with less distance and slower, sure. But get to where you can run 8 minute or less miles for at least 3 of them. That's the standard. 2 minutes of sit-ups, max effort, and increase over time. Max push-ups, pull-ups, lather, rinse, repeat. Good advice. This is good advice when you're not at war. Why are you out of shape? Why are you making excuses? We are over 2 months into this year. And how's it going for you? Are you still making excuses? Well, stop it. Get to work. Now, for me, I'm doing a lot of indoor, aerobic, endurance-related stuff. I'm not running because every year I've tried it, I end up coughing for a month afterwards because of the cold. So I do all my stuff indoors during the winter, and as soon as the winter is over, I start with interval running, which is basically you go in your neighborhood and you run just to the wall, to the next mailbox, until you can run to the wall for two mailboxes and then stop running to the wall and just run and get to the point where you can do an 8-minute mile. And it's doable. And I didn't used to think I could run. I honestly told myself, hey, you're just not built for running. You're like a Clydesdale. You know, it's more for hauling stuff around. No, that's nonsense. You will exceed the goals you set if you act them out. If you say to yourself, I can't do it, you won't, because you're right. But if you say, I can do it, you will, because you're right. I continue. He says, get healthy, stop eating junk, balance meals, wipe out the sugar. Nah, that's not going to happen. Fat and junk food. Get your teeth fixed. Get anything else you need taken care of. He's talking glasses. If you can do LASIK. If I could do LASIK, I would do LASIK. I can't do it because of the years wearing contacts. My eyes are actually too thin. I could get that lens replacement thing, but I'm not doing that. So get glasses, get all that stuff updated. Cut back on the alcohol and junk the nicotine habit. Spend your money you save from those vices on more important supplies. That's really good advice. I know some of you smoke, some of you drink a lot, and those are expensive habits. I just skipped ahead a little bit here. So spend money you save from those vices on more important supplies like stored food, medical supplies, ammo, tools. You can party when you're using the skulls of your enemies for cups. Until then, self-discipline, medical care may not be around much longer, and healthy people fight harder, and they're harder to kill. I repeat, get healthy. And there's some healthy things you can't do. If you have a medical condition, let's say it's high blood pressure, well, there's just a limit to what you can do to fix that. Sometimes you just have high blood pressure. If it's a thyroid condition, if it's diabetes, there's just some things you can't fix. But you can get healthier, and you can hold out in the fight for a lot longer and take a few of these commies with you when the war does start. I think that's overall his overarching point. D, learn what an unconventional warrior needs to know. I don't know you or your area or what you're up against. You should. And then learn what you'll need to deal with that. At a minimum, you should be focusing on what the ground forces, Army and Marines, teach their basic recruits. Even if you're too old to participate, you should still have the knowledge in your brain pan. And if that's the case, learn tradecraft. Scouting, spying, information gathering, recording, encryption, decryption, transmission, collection, and analysis. Too scared? Focus on supporting activities. Caching, sheltering, running a safe house, supply, small-scale manufacturing, reloading, finance, medical support, feeding, transportation, all means truck, rail, waterborne, pack, animal, repair, communications, construction, field engineering, anything from shovels to heavy equipment, and so on. E, find and vet other people doing A through D above. Hint, over 50% of those are federal CIs. I don't know if that's true, but you gotta kind of go in with that attitude. If you get to where your main strategy to avoid prison is jury nullification because you were a moron about vetting, you've screwed the pooch beyond repair, and you deserve to die in prison. Whether or not you do so is up to a merciful deity, because the powers that be will have no sense of humor, and fate is set to zero F's given when you're stupid. And F says, as Sam Culper has said and taught and teaches, like his classes, take his classes, do an area study. Look the term up online. He's right. It's not hard. Do an area study. That's already 5 more things than most people out there have done. And that's enough to get you started. Provided you start getting started. Whatever you haven't done above is where you are. Get busy with that first. Leviathan isn't going to wait all day before taking an interest in you. And that's what I've been thinking a lot lately. And at some point, people just, stuff's going to happen. And clearly we look around and nobody's doing anything. So the only thing to do is wait till somebody's doing something. Or maybe you're the one that should be doing something. I don't know. And on the graphic on Western rifle shooters, it says, keep calm and learn how to kill communists. There's another one. No one is coming to save you, including Trump. Now what's your plan? I love that, because there's still people today think that it's all going to work itself out. I hope the latest Supreme Court saying, nah, we're not going to look at this. No, never mind. Oh, it's too late. Election's over, so no point in talking about election fraud. See? No one's coming to save you. And then this graphic is a blurry picture of the Wolverine with the Wolverine from the original Red Dawn holding the rifle near. And it says, locate commies in your area. You know what to do. Want to thank the show sponsor, Act to Care of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. Act to Care is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. If you're looking for in-home senior care in the Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell County, out in the country, areas of Central Virginia, give Act to Care a call. Get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. And John and his awesome staff will take care of you and mention that you heard them on Radio Free Virginia. So one of the things I've been looking at doing to raise money for the show is actually merch, trying to come up with some merch ideas. And so I'll be rolling this out probably in the next 4 weeks. I'm still trying to source some of the things that I'd like to get done. One is a patch, which is essentially the show logo, but it says, of course, on the bottom, Six Emperor Tyrannus. And at the top, I want to have it say Victory or Death. So I'll sell those patches, Velcro backed, so you can put them on your gear. Another one is Virginia helicopter tours. And I haven't figured out all the wording and whatnot, but essentially Virginia helicopter tours. If you have listened to my episode on Pinochet, you'll get what I'm saying there. And I think that'll be a fun kind of subliminal hidden meaning thing that I think a lot of people will get. So that's a couple of the things I'm doing. There are some print-on-demand services that I'm looking at, and then I'll probably do a pre-order for them, get that out there, and get the initial batch funded, and we'll see. I don't know. I'll update you when I get that going. So as I mentioned, the rules have been slightly relaxed for COVID in Virginia. Just a miracle. I tell you, it's a miracle that as soon as Donald Trump is no longer president, magically COVID goes away. That's just miraculous, I tell you. And here we are. COVID has gone away, and we are still not able to live our lives as we were before. And I saw a great video today of this guy standing out. He's in a tracksuit and he's got a lint roller, and he's telling people to put their arms up. And as they come up, he kind of rubs the lint roller around on them a little bit, and they go inside. And he does this for, the video has a good 10 people that he's doing this to, and every single one of them complies. We have become the most compliant bunch of drones, non-thinking idiots that I've ever seen. And I saw it the other day when I was heading down the road, getting onto the freeway, and there was traffic. Well, there's never traffic here. Why is there traffic? I look up ahead. I can probably see a half a mile up the road. There's a police officer, and he's actually, it was a woman, state trooper, had pulled somebody over. And everyone was merging into the fast lane. Now, what you need to do in Virginia is you have to move over if you can. If you can't, you have to proceed with caution. You don't have to get out of the dang slow lane and move all into the fast lane, brain dead idiots. So I'm watching this freak show happen in front of me and just losing my mind, pounding on the steering wheel, screaming, just because I know what's causing this. This COVID compliance has led us to no longer think and use our brains. Because what was happening is somebody's moving over, so everyone goes, well, I guess I should move over. And the next guy goes, I guess I should move over. And the next guy says, I guess I should move over. And so I said, I'm not moving over, and just zoomed around everybody, went slow by the police officer, zoomed on ahead, and everyone's probably going, I can't believe what that guy just did. Can you believe that, Stella? Insane. It's absolutely insane. And we have become the sheep people like us always talk about, which is pretty terrifying when you think about it. It changes the whole dynamic of what needs to happen. You know, in a second, I'm going to read from I Led Three Lives Again. There is something that could have saved the Russian people. And it was killing all of the communists. But they thought, well, this will all work itself out. Surely, they're not going to just come into our neighborhoods and shoot us and take us off to the gulag. Surely that won't happen. There was a time in Nazi Germany, if you had shot the Nazis, that there would have been no Nazi Germany. There was a time in communist China where if you had shot Mao and his leaders and the other communists, that would have been the end of it. And I'm not talking in war, I'm talking in general. There is a time throughout the communist takeover of Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia, where if you had shot Robert Mugabe and other communist leaders, that's it. End of the game. But no. It'll all work itself out, I'm sure. Just keep putting blinders on. Keep living that fantasy that someone's coming to save you. No one is coming to save you. Contrary to what your mama told you when you were a kid, violence does solve problems. It does. Maybe that's another shirt I should do. It does solve problems. And we got problems. This is unlike anything America has ever faced. And I don't know what the solution is to get people to wake up to that. Do this as an experiment. Maybe you're a mask compliant person. I hope you're not, but maybe you are. Don't wear one next time you go in the store. Don't do it. Doesn't matter what store. There's no law that says you have to wear a mask. Everyone's just doing it because everyone's doing it. So don't wear a mask and then walk around. Count how many people are not wearing a mask. You'll be lucky if you can find one other person in the store. That should scare you. That level of sheepish compliance should terrify you. Because if they'll comply with that, well, the boxcar. Okay, they told me to get on the boxcar. I guess we're going to a new place, right? Will there be food there? Maybe. Not for long. It's been the history of tyranny. So wake up. So we continue the saga of Herb Philbrick, patriot, spy, counter-spy for the FBI. And he is a patriot. We know more about communism's inner workings because of this book than I think any federal report or House Un-Americans Committee report that we could ever read. This is the inner workings of the communist system as it bears itself out inside our own country.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
What is communism? I've been on the inside of communism. I still have contacts. From this knowledge, I tell you as simply and seriously as I know how. Communism is a lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined, as J. Edgar Hoover says, a criminal conspiracy. I'm choosing these words deliberately. Lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, determined, and international criminal conspiracy. This is the true nature of the enemy. This is communism.
Chapter 12, Training for Revolution. Secret underground presses are a vital adjunct to the Communist Party in every non-communist nation, including the United States. Propaganda and deception are the keystones on which the movement to subvert a people and their government must be built. Communication and agitation by means of the printed word, through pamphlets, magazines, leaflets, and newspapers, are essential to the structure. During the legitimate phase of Communist Party activity, printing operations are carried on through legal, above-ground presses. But every party member is instructed that in any nation, as communism gains strength and becomes a serious threat, vigorous countermeasures will be taken by heavy-handed legal authorities to suppress it. And one of the first of these will be an effort to close down the presses which grind out reams of agitprop, agitation propaganda, material daily. If its presses could actually be shut down, the party would suffer crippling blows. But the fact is they cannot. For as the party goes deeper and deeper underground, its presses go with it, and operations continue more energetically than ever. Communists in the United States are well prepared for the ultimate outlawing of their presses. As early as 1945, when I became a member of the Six-Man Educational Commission of the Massachusetts Communist Party, I first became acutely aware of the existence and constant strengthening of a far-flung network of underground presses. Some of the party's standby presses and equipment are kept in dead storage against the day when they may have to be used. There is also a considerable stockpile of scarce paper and printing ink held in reserve. But for the most part, the underground party press is already on an operational footing, not lying idle and concealed in secret cellars. They are working in the open behind legitimate and respectable business fronts, making and taking in money through every available source for their own support. In some cases, they represent large and well-known printing and publishing houses. But they are run by trusted party comrades who will be ready to take them underground when the word is given. In the meantime, they frequently turn out covert material for the party, material which is inadvisable to print on the organization's open and legal presses. My job as assistant advertising manager of the M&P Theaters in Boston brought me into close contact with the printing and publishing trades, and also with the Communist Underground Press. First of all, the party made use of me, sandwiching its publication orders for its front groups into my regular business orders, and I learned which printers were in the pocket of the party. I was instructed to take care to spread these jobs around to avoid giving too much of them to one house. I paid the bills in cash and was reimbursed by the party headquarters. As a member of the propaganda division of the party, I came to know many of its skilled personnel, including its printing shop operators. Because of my close affiliation with commercial printing houses, I was invited to inspect the newest secret party presses in Boston. A complete modern shop set up to handle job printing by the offset method. The advantage of offset is that it can handle reprints without setting type, or if necessary, can eliminate the linotype altogether. The party asked me to look over the plant and offer any suggestions for efficient operation. I did a thorough job for the party, then I went a step further. "Let me have a few samples of your work to show around," I suggested. "Perhaps I can throw some work your way." I was given a full set of all the types of work produced on the press. It was most considerate of the party to let me have them. They went directly to the FBI, where they doubtless are still on file, a set of fingerprints with the distinctive characteristics through which any work turned out in the future by the same press can be traced. In addition, I obtained a complete inventory of the plant's equipment, including the model numbers for every important piece of apparatus. As a good party member, it was wise for me to help provide the necessary smokescreen for the press operations. Accordingly, one day, when a good non-communist friend, Sam Baker, a salesman for the Lithomat Company, approached me with a problem, I was glad to help him. "Herb," he said, "I've heard of a job to be done in a hurry. Its offset runs about 300 pages, but it's such a short run that the printer, who has it now, doesn't want to bother with it. The job would be done before they could get their presses rolling at normal speed. Any suggestions?" "Sure, I know the solution," I said, thinking of the party offset press that I had inspected. "I know a good printer, just getting started. I'm sure he'd be glad to take it and give you a good price, too." I gave Sam the name and address of the shop. Sometime later, I called again at the printing shop on another mission. "Say," the printer spoke up after we had finished our business, "that was a nice job your friend Sam Baker had in his pocket. A United States government job." "A government job?" I tried to show some enthusiasm, but I could feel my blood run cold. Perhaps I had made a terrible blunder. Sam Baker had told me nothing about the government, and naturally, he did not know he was dealing with a communist press. My first thought was the possibility of espionage, but the party had made a mistake too. "Yep," said the printer. "Too bad we had to turn it down." "Turn it down?" I exclaimed. "Why'd you do that?" "Security. We would have had to get clearance before we could have the job. We're in no position to be investigated by a bunch of FBI snoopers. I didn't think they would find a thing wrong with us, but headquarters said they didn't want to run the risk just now." "Oh," I sympathized with some relief. "That's too bad. What did you tell Sam?" "Just that we weren't set up well enough yet to handle that many plates for quick delivery. While party presses are available for quantity printing, many of the most highly secret documents were produced on a little headquarters mimeograph machine, which I had rebuilt and frequently operated. In the fall of 1945, the party carefully screened 1,500 communists in the Boston area to attend a super-secret training school in Marxism. I was selected as one of the 16 candidates. Outlines for the courses were prepared from a master copy provided by the party's national headquarters. Extreme caution was decreed to prevent the study outline from falling into the hands of any comrade outside the school. A limited number of copies was run off on the mimeograph, enough for each of the 16 students and the instructors who would handle the training. It was a valuable document. It showed how Marxism was to be taught in Boston and elsewhere too, no doubt as a living and fighting force applicable to our own times and our own country. It was a simple matter to get it into the hands of the Bureau. After each stencil was typed, I slipped out the thin fiber paper lining the backing sheet, stuffed them into my pockets, and mailed them to the FBI. The government had the full course outlined before any of the students saw it. The secret teacher training course was scheduled for 8 sessions, one night a week, to be held in October and November in 1945 at the West End Communist Club off Scollay Square in downtown Boston. The appointed evening for the first session was cold and dismal. I worked late in my office on the square, then stepped out for a bite of supper at Joe and Nemo's restaurant. From there, cognizant of party instructions to avoid any chance of detection, I wound my way back up the dark, narrow streets of Beacon Hill, then proceeded up the narrow part of Hancock Street and moved downhill again toward the square. The hill was almost deserted. In contrast to the evening crowds moving through adjacent Scollay and Bowdoin Squares, walking down the rough brick surface of Hancock Street, I slowed my pace and surveyed the scene. It was deserted, except a few passers-by at the foot of the street. A single street lamp on the corner cast deep shadows into the doorways of the old Beacon Hill buildings. No one loitered at the intersection with the square. I expected to find some kind of FBI lookout. A parked car, a truckman repairing a flat tire, a drunken bum, some evidence of a plant, but I was unable to detect a single one. Crossing the street toward the corner, two-story brick building, I slipped in the doorway of number 3 Hancock Street, ostensibly the headquarters of the Bricklayers Union, actually the blind for the West End Communist Club and the secret training school. I stood in a dim hallway, from which led to a broad flight of wooden stairs. At first there was no sound, then I heard muffled voices from the floor above. I went up the stairs, turned down a narrow corridor into which the only light spilled through the glass partition in one of the offices. Opening the door, I found a small room lighted by a single ceiling lamp. There was a table laden with overcoats, hats, and scarves. To the left was another table and 3 chairs. There were 4 or 5 rows of folding chairs facing the table. At the table, Fanny Hartman sat in whispered conversation with a woman whose back was to me, but whose hair, even under the dim light, was markedly red. I permitted my glance to move quickly over the faces of the students without lingering or showing any signs of recognition. There were only a few in the group known to me by sight or by name. I tossed my coat on top of the others, took a seat at the rear of the class, and rocked my chair back against the hot radiator. No word of greeting was spoken to me. One member of the class turned sideways and raised a finger in salutation. I smiled back and turned my attention to the instructor's table, squinting past the yellow ball of light hanging from the ceiling. Then I nearly fell out of my tilted chair. The young woman with the red hair was Dr. Hulda McGarvey. I had previously encountered Hulda in connection with the Sam Adams School for Social Studies and regarded her as one of the many misguided liberals enticed into teaching posts in the Communist Front Training School. but I was shocked to see her face in the inner circle of the Communist Party. A graduate of Smith College and Columbia University, a former instructor at Mount Holyoke College, and an assistant professor of psychology at Smith. She was a highly regarded academician, unknown for any intimate Communist Party connections. Fanny Hartman glanced about the room and, assured that her full class was assembled, passed out the course outlines. Then, as the woman boss of the district party, she went to work. "Comrades," her soft voice was like the stropping of a razor in a still room, "you all realize this is not simply a routine course in Marxism-Leninism. You are all experienced enough, I hope, to know most of the facts of Marxist-Leninist teachings. If not, you wouldn't be here. This is a course to instruct you how to teach others, how to train your own comrades. You will have the responsibility of training our cadres so that they in turn can go out and win the workers to the socialist struggle against the fascist imperialists of the world, and in particular, the United States. This is a long-range program, part of an organized campaign throughout the party to rid every unit of the last vestiges of Browderism, to deepen the understanding of Marxist-Leninist theory." She leaned forward in her chair for emphasis. "In particular, you will study the application of Marx and Lenin to the conditions of the United States today. Your responsibilities will include organizing city and branch schools, and you will carry out a systematic checkup of Marxist study in every cell. You will lead some of the educational classes yourself, and you will instruct others to lead similar classes." The class members shuffled about in their chairs and settled down for a long session. I began making notes. Fanny delved into the importance of the tactics of proper teaching. "A good instructor," she explained, "can teach and influence any person along communist lines, no matter what his position in life. Take the Communist Manifesto, which all of you have read. Now, this great work can be given to anybody to read and study, whether he is a member of the bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie, or the proletariat. But the method of presenting it must be different in each case. We know that in the strategy and tactics of the class struggle, everything depends upon the conditions, the time, and the place. In the educational work of the party, everything depends upon the individual, his position in society, and especially his attitude toward that position. What does that mean? Of course," she went right on, not waiting for an answer from the class, "it means that for one person, we must say that the Communist Manifesto is a great historical document, a masterpiece 100 years old written by a great student of human nature and human history. Anyone, even the most reactionary capitalist or the most conservative bourgeoisie, might be convinced to read and study the manifesto on this cultural and historic level. For the non-communist working man, it does not have to be sugar-coated. In teaching the manifesto to the working class, we say that it contains the answers to all the evils under which those people work. Wage cuts, high prices, depressions, and loss of jobs. It is the key, but only the key, to open the door to further Marxist understanding. Workers must be urged to use that key as an entrance to further study. Later, if we do a good job, it will become to them what it is to us, a guide to action. Action, and not a mere historical document. It is especially a guide to action, insofar as the need for revolution to overthrow capitalist imperialism is concerned. But we do not teach this to new members or to prospective members at the outset. We must lead them gradually, step by step, to lay the foundation first. That, of course, is the main purpose of our public courses in the Sam Adams School and others like it." Fanny turned the class over to Huldah McGarvey, who started us off with the party definition of the three classes of society. First, she said, there is the bourgeoisie, the 60 top capitalist class family who own and control the nation's means of production. These people, inevitably, are the enemies of the working class, and with some notable exceptions, in the case of the disgruntled and idealistic members, cannot be won to the communist side. It is this class which must be attacked without mercy, which, in the end, must be crushed and liquidated, together with their state machines for the exploitation of the working class. The proletarians, the masses of the working party, are the natural allies of the party. They own no means of production, but earn their living through their labor. They are at all times at the mercy of the landlords, the bankers, and the bourgeoisie bosses. It is from the proletariat that most recruits must be enrolled into the Communist Party. The petty bourgeoisie represent a special class, Huldah said, and special conditions must be observed for handling it. This is the great middle class, especially in the United States, the professional people, Of course, the instructor explained, we know that the middle class is vanishing. It is being crushed between the inexorable conditions of capitalist masters and capitalist slaves, but it is still large enough to constitute a separate class. Actually, Holda droned on, the petty bourgeoisie, small businessmen, shopkeepers, independent operator, is a dupe and a fool. He is no more capitalist than the ordinary working man. He has no control over his destiny, but he imagines that he has. He is the tool of the capitalist who can and does crush and extinguish them at will. Therefore, the petty bourgeoisie is in reality a member of the proletariat, the only difference being that he does not know it. We can sometimes win these people over if we present the facts properly. Certain members of the petty bourgeoisie can become extremely valuable allies. But since the average person in this class imagines himself to be a capitalist, he is dangerous to us because of his stupidity. In a crisis, he becomes an ally of the capitalist, and they must be crushed and destroyed together. Holda closed with the discussion of the application of socialist and communist literature to the various classes. She stressed the necessity of gauging the proper level of a raw recruit and said that it was impossible to start off immediately by teaching the urgency of revolution. To do so would scare the prospect away. He must be started at the right place, then brought along step by step, without losing control on the way. There was a brief question and answer period, but few questions were asked, all of them routine. We were dismissed, donned our coats, and disappeared singly or in small groups, once again into the street. I surveyed the scene and found no one in the vicinity of the building as I plodded up Beacon Hill. Within a few days, I found another cryptographic message on my desk requesting a personal contact with the Bureau the following morning. To meet the appointment, I left the house early for work and stopped at a diner near the city limits, where I frequently filled my vacuum bottle with morning coffee. The place was almost empty. The morning's run of hungry truckmen had come and gone. As I stepped to the counter, I was greeted in a loud voice by a man behind me, seated in the corner booth where I expected to find him. "Well," I effused, "fancy seeing you here." I walked over and shook hands, and we raised a blather of, "How are you? Fine, fine. How have you been?" "Join me for a cup of coffee?" suggested the FBI agent, who was indulging in a breakfast pastry. I accepted and sat down. We continued to chatter idly while my coffee was brought. "How's the family?" I asked, knowing full well he had none. "Say," he reached into his inner coat pocket, "I have those pictures we took at the picnic." He produced a sheaf of snapshots and passed them across the table to me. On the top was a smiling young woman, a child on each side of her. "Good shot," I said. There was no one near the booth now. I turned my back to the window as if to get better light. The counterman was serving another customer at the far end of the diner. I peeled off the top picture. Next was a close-up of me in semi-profile, wearing hat and top coat, with the doorway of number 3 Hancock Street plainly visible in the background. "Not bad," I said. There followed a succession of pictures of Dr. Holda McGarvey, Fanny Hartman, my old friend Joe, and Margot Clark, and each one of them students of the secret Hancock Street School, all snapped as they left the building. The faces had the pale-lipped, ghostly translucence of infrared blacklight photography. "I'll be darned," I said, recalling my careful scrutiny of the street corner, during which I had tried in vain to pick out the possible hidden camera post. "I didn't even know you took these." "No?" he smiled. We spoke freely and with no effort to subdue our voices. "Candid pictures are the best, by the way. Some of that crowd that came in with you, I didn't know too well. Would you mind putting down their names for my album?" I turned the pictures over. Several of them, including some I didn't know, were already marked, identified. The rest I filled in as best I could, either with their party pseudonyms or their real names. And in the end, nearly everyone in the course was pinned down for the FBI files. The special class continued one night a week, 2 hours or more each session, constantly increasing the anti-capitalist and revolutionary intensity. More than 25 textbooks were used. This was ostensibly nothing more than a study of the classics, as any of these people would have insisted on a witness stand. But it was plainly no mere cultural pursuit. The austere nature of the classroom, the grim aspects of the students, assembling intently each week at the appointed hour to scrutinize the history of socialist and communist revolutionary movements, the absence of humor, the discipline of the class, the purposefulness of the instructors sitting at the table with the naked light slashing across their faces, all these were the marks of a true conspiracy. It was understandably necessary for them to speak in circumlocutions, to the use of the Aesopian dodges of communist lingo. After all, the Communist Party was even then working under the shadow of the Smith Act, making the teaching and advocacy of violent revolution a crime in the United States. The law was passed without fanfare in 1940 and was directed at that time more at fascist organizations than at the communists. Now the communists recognized the law as being applicable to their own teachings, which they took great pains to cloak in the greatest secrecy. Yet I was amazed at the transparency of the disguise. The instructors, Fanny Hartman, Dr. McGarvey, and Comrade Sam, put across some of their points by innocent historical example, citing and elaborating upon pertinent passages in the revolutionary classics. Constantly they admonished us to bear in mind that we understand these things, but not everyone you will teach has such understanding. Certainly, a new member is not expected to have full knowledge of the tactics and strategy of the party. He must be led by degrees to a better appreciation of the facts by gradually raising the level of his understanding. Raise the level. Raise the level. But we understood. Otherwise, as Fanny said, we would not have assembled here in this chill atmosphere, poor light, and personal discomfort hour after hour to go over it. We as students knew that when the instructor spoke of the materialist order of constant and inevitable changes in society, they meant now, today, not 1789 in France or 1914 in Russia. We knew that when they told us man's destiny is conditioned by events over which he has no control, they meant today's man, not some historical creature caught up in the past upheaval. We knew that when they said violent revolution is one of the abrupt changes decreed by the laws of nature, they were not speaking of history, but metaphorically, they were endeavoring to shape future events. We knew that when they said violent revolution was necessary for the overthrow of the capitalist czardom, they meant that it would be equally necessary for the ultimate overthrow of capitalist imperialism in the United States. There was no room for misinterpretation of this line. No alternative political or social thesis were taught. It was straight down the line toward Marxist revolution. We were under no illusions as to what was meant when we were told the ballot box and orderly procedure do not suffice, that man is antipathetic to reforms by legal process, and that armed force alone will suffice. We knew all this well from our years of Marxist indoctrination. I knew it, and still when Fanny Hartman took off her mask and laid it out in plain language, I almost dropped my pencil and forgot to take my notes. Once we have taught that all of this is perfectly natural, Fanny said, that it has to be expected, then we are ready to state our position. And what is the definition of revolution? Do we mean something like the Industrial Revolution? No. We mean violent revolution to be carried out by armed bands of workers, led by the Communist Party, the vanguard of the working class. Only through such revolution can socialism be established. Only with the Communist Party as the leader can the revolution be successful. And stillness fell when she stopped speaking. Not a foot shuffled. This was outright sedition, the first such blunt assertion of it I had ever heard in party councils. I felt a paradoxism of excitement as I transcribed her words for detailed quotation in my report to the Bureau. In the report, I superimposed one of my rare interpretations onto the bare facts. There are no holds barred now, I said. This takes us back to the naked Bolshevik line with no trimmings. One night, a dark stranger occupied a place at the instructor's table. He was given no introduction to the class. His appearance was very brief, and he only had a few words to say to the class. But it soon became apparent that his soft voice carried the weight of the National Politburo. He spoke of the reconstitution of the party, the reestablishment of rigid Marxism in every segment of the party organization, the renewal of the struggle against bourgeoisie influences. Comrades, he added, as a result of the war, we have seen a great intensification of the contradictions between the two world systems, socialism and capitalism. In this country, we shall see a sharper growth of fascism and the building of the class struggle, which will eventually bring the establishment of socialism. The party does not consider the raising of the question of revolution as an immediate slogan for action. We must first recognize the party as its vanguard role and function as the leader of the American proletariat. Under Browder's revisionism, we have become soft. This calls for a special evaluation and for an increase in our internal as well as our external vigilance. Externally, we must defeat red baiting and anti-communism. Internally, We must take special measures to protect our party organization and membership. We must deal ruthlessly with the agents of the enemy. You, he said, his eyes passing around the room and missing none of us, will have special responsibilities in this task. My special responsibilities soon became plain. After one of the class sessions toward the end of the course, Fanny Hartman stopped me at the door and drew me aside. There will be a special meeting of the new group at the office Saturday afternoon, she told me, out of earshot of the others. 2:00. Be sure to be there. On the following Saturday, I passed the morning at the M&P theaters, cleaning up some back work. Then, after lunch, I proceeded to district headquarters, rode the elevator to the 6th floor, and walked down a flight on the fire stairs and entered the Communist Party headquarters. The meeting was held in Fanny Hartman's inner sanctum. But I was surprised to discover that Fanny was not there. Present in the room was Justine O'Connor, Otis Hood, a gnome-like little man, and another big, hulking brute, neither of whom I'd ever seen before. At a later date, we were joined by the lanky and brilliant Daniel Boone Shermer, but at this first meeting, there were no introductions, not even by first names. The big man occupied Fanny Hartman's place and seemed to take over her job as well. He talked more freely than Fanny, in a loud, positive voice. He gave orders bluntly. Many of his statements he put in the form of questions, to which answers were self-evident. The group of 6 communists came to be known among us privately as the Jack Satchel Group for New England. More formally, it was the District Educational Commission of the Communist Party, operating directly under Jack Satchel as the National Educational Director, but we seldom saw him in person. Everyone knew and stood in awe of the name of Jack Satchel. In the peculiar half-light of information shed upon the leading functionaries of the party, his authority was carried more by inference than by direct communication. It was my impression that not many comrades were permitted to meet him face to face. Satchel, then about 45, also known as Jankel, Jacob Zunzer, and Moses Brown, had been a professional revolutionary all of his adult life. He had shortly before been made the National Educational Director of the Communist Party, and in 1949 was indicted as one of the top 12 communist leaders. The big man who ran the group at the outset was Emanuel, or Manny Blum, a New York-trained communist sent by national headquarters to New England to replace Fanny Hartman as district organizer. There were policy differences between Fanny and the National Committee, the precise nature of which was never made plain. It was an unfortunate day for the party in New England when the domineering and bludgeoning Manny Blum displaced the sharp and rapier-like Fanny Hartman. But displace her he did, and the organization and indoctrination of the Jack Satchel Group was the first stage in a maneuver to shoulder Fanny Hartman out of power in the district. The members of the group had no direct contact with each other, except on occasion, when we were assembled for periodic reports. We were assigned to work in various congressional districts into which the party was subdivided for political activities. I drew the 8th Congressional District of Massachusetts as my territory. We were to operate in all the branches and cells of our areas as educational and literature directors, visiting, talking, teaching, circulating, and inquiring. Manny Blum indicated the line of our inquiry. We do not worry about people like Bud Enns. Is he not already discredited by his own treason? Of what consequence is Bud Enns? We are probably enrolling more Bud Ennses into the party even now. Let us look at this sensibly. Manny gave a laugh. We were a select group in the privacy of his office now, and he could speak with even more than his customary frankness. Someone comes into the party in 1946. He works for us, say 10 years, 15 years, hard labor. Then he quits the party. So, it is 1946 when he joins. It may be 1961 before he deserts us. We shall always have a certain number of deserters, traitors. But are we going to worry today because we will have a traitor in 1961? We will politely discredit him as a turncoat. No one will trust him. Manny smiled at the consternation written on our faces. Then his smile vanished, and his swarthy face clouded. The time to stop a traitor is before he can become a traitor. In Russia, they deal with such things realistically. Here, in this country, we have a capitalist government which spawns traitors, offers them sanctuary, the honor, and the reward for their treason. But, someone said, shouldn't Bud Enns and others like him have their reward too? Not every traitor, Manny interjected, accomplishes his plans. After all, it is most difficult. Naturally, to protect our party and our members, we should not make it easy for them, eh? Under such circumstances, it is unlikely that they should commit suicide. Or are there not other conditions that may cause them to reconsider? But we must recognize that some people will be weakened by bourgeoisie influences. It is up to us, to you, to find out who these people are. Discover them, weed them out, eliminate them, destroy them. In plain language, Manny was giving us a mission to spy on party members. The assignment gave me more than a moment's pause. First of all, life was becoming enormously complex for me. On one page, I was a conservative businessman, suburban churchgoer, liberal Republican, civic enterpriser. On the next, I was a deep-dyed member of the Communist Party of New England, sitting in on its multifarious conspiracy. Between the lines, I was a Federal Bureau of Investigation confidential agent, striving to perform a service. Within these categories, there were already more subdivisions than I could keep track of. Now the party itself was grooming me for still another role. That of a member of a sort of junior review commission, with the task of strengthening the very movement I was trying to fight, by ferreting out its weaklings and potential traitors. I was burrowing so deep that I feared I might yet be trapped in the catacombs. There were shocks and surprises at almost every turn, in business and within the party. There were so many snares and traps tossed in my path that it was almost impossible to avoid tripping up somewhere along the way. My father, Guy Philbrick, for many years a railroad man in Boston, stormed red-faced into my office one day after his morning run from Portsmouth to Boston, on the Boston and Maine. He was seething with anger. In his hands he waved a leaflet. "I have been picking these up all over the North Station," he fumed. "Who do these people think they are, anyway? Who do they represent?" He glanced at the leaflet and tossed it disdainfully on my desk. "Railway Employees Branch of the Communist Party of New England," Dad snorted. I contrived to examine the leaflet with deep concern. It was a piece of routine agitational literature concerning the hours, wages, and working conditions of railway employees. It was issued in the name of the party branch whose title Dad had read. I knew the answer to his question. The Railway Employees Branch was a figment of my own imagination, a designation invented by me with the approval of my party superiors, created for a special campaign among railway workers. I wrote the propaganda leaflet myself and helped with the arrangements for its distribution among Boston and Maine employees at the North Station. I agreed with Dad that it was not so good, but I could find no humor in some of my more recent discoveries. Here in the so-called Statchel Group, I was dealing with the hardened party professionals. Hood, Justine O'Connor, Shermer, and Blum were all paid officials of the party, deriving at least part of their livelihood from their position. The gnomish man who turned out to be Max Weitzman and I were the only volunteer party workers in the new district educational commission. The cynicism and duplicity of the salaried officials was a revelation to me, even in my role as a Marxist. Rank and file members were extorted constantly to fight fascism in the United States, and it was our job as educational commissioners to keep up the fight. But in private, our conversations had a different color. Take, for example, the arch enemy of the communists, the old House Committee on Un-American Activities, which was shortened by party members, not alone for the sake of brevity, to the Un-American Committee. "The House Committee? Bah," Manny Blum would say. "How much more are we helped than we are harmed? What can they do? They call us before the committee, so we put on a suitable performance. Everything depends upon the conditions, the time, and the place. Going before the House Committee is a chance for winning as many friends as we can to the party, and creating as many enemies of the American Congress as possible." Boone Shermer voiced agreement. Lenin says, "We do not seek to cover up the contradictions in capitalism, but we seek to expose and unravel them. We don't try to cover up the fascist trend or minimize the class struggle. The faster the development of fascism, the greater the increase in the class struggle. The bigger the growth of bureaucracy, the nearer the day of socialism." Within the Statchel Group, a group dominated by professional party workers, there was then no genuine concern that the United States was, as we told the rank and filers, heading straight for the fascist state. It was to the interest of the party that the country became more fascist, not less. And yet, outside of its secret councils, the Communist Party posed with its own membership as the champion for anti-fascism. The same double standard applied to the direction of the party's firing line. Down among the lowly grubbers, work them into the most precarious positions, and hope that trouble will brew. we were told. Once a grubber gets cracked over the head with a police club, we don't have to argue with him about the existence or non-existence of police brutality. It would not serve any purpose that I could see for me to become an expert snooper for the party. I had no stomach for it. If some member of the party could be persuaded to turn his coat, all to the good. In all of my party work, there came a time when I had to draw the line. I was not so anxious to root out any enemy agents among which the FBI had first place. Furthermore, I didn't like the implication behind the phrase, destroy them. This was an ambiguous term, to which one might apply any number of meanings. Then there was the delightful preposition that, in Russia, they deal with such things realistically. The prime example of the reward of a deviationist, which every casual student of history must know, was that of Leon Trotsky, who was assassinated by Stalin's agents in Mexico on August 21, 1940. Instances came within the range of my experience which proved for me that disciplinary measures taken to silence a traitor could be of a very permanent nature. I attended one conference in which the impending liquidation of a member was discussed. It did not take place, I am glad to report. On another occasion, a responsible party functionary bragged that a communist suspected by the party of being a government agent had successfully committed suicide. And finally, I was told on reliable authority that a comrade thought to be weak and unreliable was literally driven to suicide by his communist friends. The course I followed as the party counter-spy in the Stachel group was to lie low, take no initiative, and to cover up as much as possible by concentrating on my less harmful function as an educational and literary director. I visited the branches and cells in my area, lugging a brown zipper bag, bulging with party pamphlets, helping to teach and organize Marxist classes and party activities on the community level, but I volunteered no reports on any findings or suspicions of party weaklings. However, my back was put to the wall. "What do you know about Comrade Whitey?" Boone Shermer asked me without warning one night at the party headquarters. I thought I knew what he was aiming at, but I wanted to duck it if possible. "Whitey?" I shrugged. "Not much. Married, no children, has his own house. Good workman, good labor union leader in the AFL. But how good a communist is he?" I was not prepared to give Shermer an answer, even if I had wanted to. "Of course, I don't see much of him, because I'm almost never in his branch, except for cell meetings." "Look into it," Shermer snapped, and turned on his heel. Whitey was the chairman of the Melrose branch of the party, an underground communist with a long record of party activity. Quite unaccustomed to the idea that I was supposed to investigate a branch chairman, I set out to do so with little enthusiasm for the job. I called at his home, became more and more friendly, met his wife, and even helped him strip wallpaper during a house renovation. Because inquisitiveness was now not only excusable to my district superiors, but also desirable, I was able to go much further with Whitey than I had ever dared to go for the Bureau. Whitey accepted my offers of friendship, and strangely enough, I liked him personally. I didn't want to blackball him, nor did I want to perform the disservice of sending him deeper into the Communist Party. My report did not condemn him, nor did it express any enthusiasm for his party abilities. Actually, Whitey and his wife were both devoted, sincere, and idealistic party members who gave much time to their cause, with no expectation of reward. I turned into the Stachel Education Commission all the details I could muster, but the report was indecisive. When it was completed, I cut off my connections with him and returned to the party's underground. As a result of the report, Whitey was not advanced to a post which had been under consideration for him. And when I last heard, he and his wife were still active in the communist movement on the West Coast, somewhere in the Seattle, Washington area. It was the last complete investigation I was called upon to make. Evidently, the party leaders concluded that I was not a competent undercover agent. They directed me to other work. So as you can see, not much has changed in the way that communists look at us and view us. A couple things that stand out here, very at the very beginning, communication and agitation by means of the printed word through pamphlets, magazine, leaflets, and newspapers are essential to the structure. So today, they have it actually much easier. They don't need underground printing presses. They have the internet. They can set up a website, the snap of a finger, and get all the information out there that they want. Here's another one. Of course, she went right on, not waiting for an answer from the class. It means that for one person, we must say that the Communist Manifesto is a great historical document, a masterpiece, 100 years old, written by a great student of human nature and human history. Anyone, even the most reactionary capitalist or the most conservative bourgeoisie, might be convinced to read and study the manifesto on this cultural, historic level. When I read this, I thought back to myself of high school. This is almost word for word the way I heard communism talked about. And this was back, I graduated in 1993. So when I say nothing's changed. You know, it's a great historical document. Talking about revolution to overthrow capitalist imperialism, they say, but we do not teach this to new members or to prospective members at the outset. We must lead them gradually, step by step, to lay the foundation first. That, of course, is the main purpose of our public courses in the Sam Adams School and others like it. But since the average person in this class imagines himself to be a capitalist, that would be independent contractors, small business owners, he is dangerous to us because of his stupidity. In a crisis, he becomes an ally of the capitalist, and they must be crushed and destroyed together. So it's interesting because on the one hand, they want to basically treat you as a small business owner, independent contractor, as very much like the working man. And at the next, they want to destroy you. This one made me laugh. I contrived to examine the leaflet with deep concern. It was a piece of routine agitational literature concerning the hours, wages, and working conditions of railway employees. It was issued in the name of the party branch whose title dad had read. I knew the answer to his question. The railway employees branch was a figment of my own imagination, a designation invented by me with the approval of my party superiors. So he's created this agitation propaganda leaflet, agitprop, and his dad gets his hands on it. He comes storming into his office, all red-faced and mad that the communists are blanketing his office. I mean, could you imagine your own father, and you can't say anything. Well, dad, don't worry about it. I needed to do that because, you know, I'm a secret agent for the FBI. It's classic. Talking about the House Un-American Activities Committee, Boone-Shermer voiced agreement. Lenin says, we do not seek to cover up the contradictions in capitalism, but we seek to expose and unravel them. We don't try to cover up fascist trends or minimize the class struggle. The faster the development of fascism, the greater the increase in the class struggle. The bigger the growth of bureaucracy, the nearer the day of socialism. Hear that? The bigger the growth of bureaucracy, the nearer the day of socialism. What dawned on me here was you hear this kind of stuff all that you don't hear it, but you see this all the time with Congress. They grow the size of government. They grow the size of government, and then they complain about the size of government. Or they rail against fascism while enacting fascist policy. The Patriot Act. The National Defense Authorization Act. No Child Left Behind. Massive government bureaucracies created and with the express purpose of instituting fascism and socialism. They rail against the education quality, then do everything they can to make the education quality worse. The same double standard applied to the direction of the party's firing line down among the lowly grubbers. Work them into the most precarious positions and hope that trouble will brew. We were told once a grubber gets cracked over the head with a police club, we don't have to argue with him about the existence or non-existence of police brutality. So they get these people, grubbers, the new party guys, they get them all riled up. This would be the Antifas. They get them to go cause trouble, spit in police officer's face, police officer whacks him in the head with a stick. Suddenly there's police brutality proof. So we see this is exactly what is going on right now. Within the last 365 days, you've seen multiple instances of this very thing. And that concludes another chapter of I Led Three Lives. I want to thank you for listening and remind you that you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.